May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Anna Eidenberg. I'm here with Sandy Karp from Karp New Hanlon PC, and we represent Martin Bouchard, DBA Martin Bouchard Construction. This case arises out of a default judgment initially entered for about $20,000 that through the years has accrued interest at the rate of $56.69 a day and currently exceeds $120,000. The circumstances surrounding the entry of the default judgment, and the subsequent collection of the judgment were so unjust and so inequitable that the interest of justice can only be served by setting aside the judgment pursuant to the court's equitable power under Rule 60B. It's undisputed that the underlying relationship between the parties was very limited and occurred in December 1999 and January 2000 when the plaintiff provided Bouchard Construction with goods and services on a construction project in Colorado. In 2000, Mr. Bouchard was sued in Colorado in county court to recover money for goods and services that were provided to him during that time period. A judgment was obtained of about $6,000 and has been collected. 2 years later in the district court, the plaintiff again sued Mr. Bouchard, arising out of the same time period, same facts and circumstances, seeking to recover money for goods and services that were provided during that time period. Mr. Bouchard was personally served with this lawsuit in New York on August 29th, and a letter dated October 1st submitted a letter to the court that would constitute an appearance under Colorado's law indicating that the rules for determining whether a party has appeared and has entered an answer are very liberal.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Eidenberg.
Please.
I understand that the letter is dated that, but it appears the only evidence we have in the record of when the court received the letter is a letter that the court wrote to your client, which says that the letter was received on October 18th. Is there any other evidence in the record that contradicts that?
There is no other evidence in the record except that the letter dated October 22nd states that the letter was received October 18th. The default judgment was entered on October 15th. So the question then arises, why did the court not advise him that default judgment had been already entered the prior week? The other issue is the fact that the court did not require the plaintiff to provide any evidence of damages. There was no evidence provided of compensatory damages in violation of Rule 55B and court case law that says that a court cannot enter a default judgment until there's been evidence either through a hearing or by affidavits to support the damages. That error, if the default was entered in the 15th, then the court should have then held a hearing on damages. 3 days after that, if the answer had been received, then the defendant should have been given notice of a hearing. But no hearing was held, no notice was held.
And there pardon me, Ms. Eidenberg, I'm sorry to interrupt again. Because the only evidence we have is that the court received the letter 3 days after the default judgment was entered, it appears that the Colorado case law does not require notice at that point because default judgment has been entered. If his letter had gotten in before the default judgment was entered, and if there was evidence of that in the record, would you agree with me that you'd have another argument, that you would say the letter beat the default judgment and thus he should have been given notice?
Yes. But the problem is that the default, before the default could have been entered. But then there's there's the difference between entry of default and then entry of the default judgment. So, for example, there's a case.
And the default judgment was entered on the 15th.
They were both entered on the same date.
Yeah.
Again, without the required evidence being provided to the court before the judgment. If I may give you an example in this case of Schaefer versus Martin, 623 P. 2nd, 77. The defendant was given notice of the was the defendant was served and filed an answer after the default had been entered. Then after the default had been entered, the court had a hearing on the default judgment but did not give him a notice of the judgment. The Court of Appeals set that aside, saying that since the defendant had filed the answer before the judgment had been entered but after the default, then the defendant should have been given notice of the hearing for the default judgment, and the answer would be considered timely because it was before the default judgment was entered. And so in that case, the Court of Appeals reinstated the answer and then let the defendant present his case. The court's error here in not requiring the...
That's not the case here.
Well, it's not the case here because the trial court never scheduled a hearing on damages.
I understand, but I'm wondering how important is the fact that the letter is received after the default judgment was entered? How important is that fact under Rule 55?
Well, it goes to the issue of whether due process was violated and therefore whether the judgment is void ab initio, but there are other grounds to set aside the judgment as well that are set forth in the brief. And then there are other equitable factors to be considered, such as the fact that the plaintiff sat on the judgment for about 6 years before domesticating it in New York. So that great period of time passed because they're now asserting that he can't move to set it aside, either on grounds that he didn't get notice or on grounds that the court erred by not requiring the plaintiff to prove damages because the period of time that passed was not reasonable. Well, the problem that, you know, they're asserting that it wasn't reasonable was because they sat on the judgment for so long, allowing it to accrue pretty much $100,000 in interest.
Well, and I'm not trying to argue with you, Ms. Eitenberg, but there are a couple questions that I'd like resolved. Your client contends that he didn't know about the letter that was sent back saying, hey, you're late, and you didn't give us a filing fee.
If I may clarify, the letter didn't say you're late. It just said you didn't give us a filing fee.
Right,
yes,
right,
he didn't
right.
know about it.
He did know about that letter?
He did not know about it.
Well, I thought in the letter, there's a discrepancy in the record here, and I'm wondering if you can tell me if the record resolves the discrepancy. In the letter, on the letter that the court received, in the upper right-hand corner, it says, return info, Martin Bouchard, gives an address in Fort Collins, Colorado. It's the same address that the court's letter was sent to. Okay. In the documents accompanying Mr. Bouchard's pro se motion to vacate the default judgment, he has an Exhibit D, and that return address isn't present on it. Can you explain from the record? I've looked. I'm wondering if the record shows why there is that difference.
Well, I thought that the version that was attached to his motion had the address and the date, but then the other one that was on file with the court didn't. But
oh, it's the other way around.
Okay. Why his does not?
Yeah.
Because
and if you don't know, you don't know. I understand.
No,
that.
I don't know, and because I thought it was the other way around. I thought maybe that when the court copied it, it may have cut off that top part or something. Because when I look at the motion and the version that's attached, I thought that the address was on that. The Exhibit D to the motion, I thought, had... the address. Well, I mean, obviously the versions the court received did have that address, if that's the court that had sent it to, but I agree. I don't have specific facts as to explain that.
Thank you. Counsel, I just have a couple of really mechanical questions. You've argued that the trial court should have given relief under Rule 60B.
Right.
Now, I just want to make sure I understand the precise mechanism that you're urging here. In part, you're saying the court should have granted relief under 60B3,
right,
and we would review that decision de novo,
right.
Correct? Okay. And what about a request for relief under 60B5?
I believe that it's an abuse of discretion standard. Um, It's set forth in my brief on page 16. An appellate court reviews a trial court's decision to grant relief under 60B5 for an abuse of discretion.
Ms. Eitenberg, I've got one last question for you. I'm sorry to be so busy today. But my last question has to do with the argument about damages. The motion that your client filed, the motion to vacate down below, appears to argue that there was fraud going on here, that there was double dipping, that we had this first judgment against me and that's been satisfied, and the second judgment is the same, and this is all fraud, and that's why you got to give me relief. I understand and appreciate that you weren't counsel at that point, and I get that, but it does not appear to me that your client in that motion raised the same argument that you're making on appeal, which is that there was not evidence of damages submitted to the court at the time of the default judgment. Would you address that, please?
The motion is not exactly the most well-written legal brief. Obviously, Mr. Bouchard is pro se, and I do want to note that there's case law that says when a party is pro se, the court should be reluctant to foreclose the ability of that party to present a defense. He says a couple of things. He cites to the one and two about the fraud. I think that the argument that he made about that it was double dipping is actually a res judicata argument, which of course he was not able to articulate. And then there is some language in there about how he never had his day in court. He does specifically say in paragraph six that his letter constitutes a sufficient appearance, and he cites to Carl's Construction versus Gigliotti, and that case stands for the proposition that when you've entered an appearance, you're entitled to notice. So while no, he did not set forth in the same manner as I did on appeal, I think that he raised the issue sufficient to preserve them for review on appeal. And the problem was with the trial court is apparently the trial court interpreted it as only raising an issue of fraud, and therefore required him to comply with a 6-month deadline, which obviously he didn't. But under the other provisions where it's just a reasonable period of time, then I think that would have been the proper standard to apply, and had that standard been applied, then he should have been granted leave to set aside the judgment and then move forward on his defense, which the plaintiff, admit in their answer is potentially meritorious. And actually the statements of fact in the answer brief of the appellee confirms that he did have a meritorious res judicata argument, that the judgment they're seeking in 2002 was satisfied in 2000. And so now he's saddled with $122,000, because the attorney he initially hired to set it aside died, and he ended up writing the brief on his own. So whatever time I have left, I would like to reserve for rebuttal. That's okay.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Stephen Latovsky. I'm an attorney for Everest Materials, LLC, the appellee. We believe that the essence of this case goes to the doctrine of finality of judgments as balanced against the countervailing policy of the need to provide relief in extraordinary circumstances where it's requested on a timely basis. We believe that there are three issues in this case, which I'm sure the court is aware of. One is, was the default judgment void for failure to give a 3-day notice of application for default judgment under Rule 50, whether the failure of Everest to provide proof of compensatory damages by affidavit and supporting documentation constitutes grounds for relief under Rule 60B5, whether the trial court abused its discretion in ruling that Bouchard, that his Rule 60B motion was not timely filed, and whether He is now precluded from raising the issue of compensatory damages for the first time on appeal. And finally, whether there are equitable considerations which support either the granting or denial of the relief requested. We're asking the court to affirm the ruling of the trial court denying the motion for relief. Initially, I would disagree with counsel. Everest does not agree that factually that it has made any admission that there was double dipping in this case, that it is a res judicata matter. Our brief does not support that conclusion. I think the court has already narrowed in on the issue of whether or not the judgment is void because of the failure to give the notice of application for default judgment. The undisputed facts show that the letter was requested, that the letter was received on the 18th. That's the evidence that we have, whether it was dated October 1st or whatever date the well-settled rule is that delivery to the court is the crucial date, not the date of mailing or the date that a document is addressed. The default judgment had already been entered by the time the court got, which we agree was a proper, would have been a notice of appearance had it been filed in a timely manner, but the default judgment had already been entered. So even if, regardless whether there was a letter of appearance or some type of answer filed by an attorney, it was not timely, and the court, Rule 55B only says that you're required to give the three-day notice of application for default judgment if a party has appeared in the case, if the defendant had appeared, and this was not the case. So the court acted properly. It entered the default judgment. At that point, Mr. Bouchard, even if the court had accepted the letter of appearance, and presumably he was given notice at the address required and in compliance with Rule 5, even though a party that Rule 5 says that a party that has not appeared in a case is not entitled to receive notice. But and it also says that it's his responsibility for giving the either arranging to forward his mail to another address or to give a change of address to the court. So that, I mean, we believe the case law clearly says in Schaefer v. Martin, the default was entered, but not the default judgment. And the court, this law is well settled that if an answer is filed before a default judgment is entered, then it's deemed timely, but that's not the case here. So we do not believe that we're dealing with a void judgment. The second issue is whether or not the fact that Everest, and we would acknowledge that we conceded that the evidence that was presented for compensatory damages does not really comply with the case law in Colorado. It should have been supported by an independent affidavit from Everest. There should have been more documentation. But our point is that this is an appellate issue. If the trial court erred in erroneously entering a judgment, then a timely appeal should have been filed. Had a timely appeal been filed, or even a motion under Rule 59 to review the court's judgment, and the court had reviewed it, or an appellate court had reviewed it back then Everest could have gone back into court. We could have had a rehearing, and the court could have considered it. But this does not go to the issue of whether or not it's a void judgment, and nobody's even arguing that.
Was that issue raised below?
No, it was not raised, Your Honor.
And why not?
I beg your pardon?
And why not? I'm sorry.
Could you rephrase?
Yeah. Why do you say that the issue was not raised below? Counsel has referred to the motion from Mr. Bouchard and said that it was in the motion. Would you explain to me why you don't think it was raised below?
You know, the motion itself asserted grounds for relief under Rule 60B, I believe 1, 2, 3, and 4. At best, and as I've explained, case law in Colorado is if a motion is raised under one of the other categories in Rule 60, then 60b-5 is residuary. You can't, if it fits into one of the other categories, then it can't be a Rule 60b-5, which is somewhat ambiguous. It was not set forth in the motion. Counsel is arguing that by implication or innuendo it should have been, and clearly the trial court did not interpret Mr. Bouchard's motion is raising a Rule 60b-5 motion. The trial court's ruling says that it wasn't filed within 6 months. It's not a void judgment. The other grounds, so if the issue had been raised, and this court has said time and again that a Rule 60 motion is not a substitute for appeal, and this is a classic case of it. If there had been a timely appeal filed again, this could have been considered in due course, but at this point, Everest has put, it's 7.5 years later. Even under IRS or Colorado ethical rulings, retention records, I believe, are 5 years and 7 years. It would be highly prejudicial to Everest to have to go in at this point and try and reconstruct its records. So that's kind of the fourth prong of Rule 60 that says on such terms as may be just.
So would you address your colleague's argument that much of the delay here is attributable to your client?
Beg your pardon?
Would you address your colleague's argument that much of the delay here is attributable to your client?
I don't necessarily agree with that statement, Your Honor. The only delay occurred from part of my client was that it delayed in filing a motion in New York State to domesticate the judgment and then started enforcement proceedings. So, and that, you know, I'm not sure that that relates to any of the issues in the case. The final issue, first of all, on compensatory damages is, even if the court were to accept that this fell into the category of a Rule 60b-5 motion, which we do not agree with, it still has to be filed in a reasonable time. The court says some of the areas have to be filed in 6 months, as the court is aware. But we agree that a Rule 60b-5 motion has to be filed in a reasonable time. Now, the facts show that Mr. Bouchard first filed his motion 7.5 years after the judgment was entered. I cannot find a case in Colorado that says that 7.5 years is a reasonable time. Even assuming that, leaving that issue aside, Mr. Bouchard became aware that the judgment had been entered in the state, you know, when proceedings were filed in the state of New York in 2008. So he had actual notice of that there was a judgment against him. He hired lawyers there. He fought the execution of the judgment. He fought the entry of the judgment. And so he had 2 years, and then he came back to call. He had actual notice for 2 years before filing it. He had actual notice of this fact, and he didn't file his motion for relief for 2 years. And we submit again that 2 years is not a reasonable period of time to move to vacate.
What do you say to Mr. Bouchard's allegation that he had retained a lawyer to do just that? The lawyer was ill, and the lawyer died. And Mr. Bouchard learned after the lawyer died that the lawyer had not done what he had requested.
Well, I knew Mr. Bauer very well, and unfortunately, his demise. I think that's a cynical argument, Your Honor. First of all, Mr. Bouchard had access to legal counsel in New York. So he wasn't totally out of the woods. He came to Colorado, and he's asking that the court treat him deferentially because he is a pro se individual in court, and the court has expressed some latitude in this regard. But when he got to Colorado, he went and hired a lawyer. He knew that he needed a lawyer, and so the you know what I have no way of knowing, and this court will never know, unfortunately, what counsel Mr. Bauer gave him, whether he advised him to proceed to do anything, and so we just can't reconstruct that. But you know, leaving that issue aside, after apparently discovered that Mr. Bauer had been deceased and had not proceeded or not filed any motions on his behalf, then he goes back in as a pro se defendant, and now he's claiming that he's entitled again to this latitude because he was pro se, even after he went and hired a lawyer. So, and again, we simply can't respond. So the second issue on compensatory damages is it was not identified in the motion for relief in the trial court. The trial court didn't have an opportunity to review that motion. It is an appellate issue. There may have been a valid grounds for reversing it if a timely appellate issue had been filed. And thirdly, it was not filed within a reasonable time. And therefore, with respect to established case law, we just believe that it would be an invalid judgment. Finally, the last argument we would make is that whatever the equities are here, Evers would be severely prejudiced if it had to go in and try and reconstruct this case. The passage of time which has occurred, I think it would set a it would open kind of the floodgates here for all sorts of motions. If we're going to use the argument that just because somebody's pro se that we can just dispense with the rules, then if just because somebody has a good argument to make, whether it's in a timely manner or 7.5 years later or 10 years later, then why don't we just modify the rules and say that you can come in at any time, ask for a default judgment, but you got to show good cause, and then we won't have all these time periods in there. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I want to go back quickly to the motion that was filed. The issue was whether he raised the argument about the judgment being void. In reviewing it again, he did actually use the words res judicata. I underestimated the motion and said, default judgments are drastic. The letter from defendant to the court is sufficient appearance under Section B to entitle defendant to a 3-day notice and a hearing. I think right there is the preservation of the argument regarding his entitlement to notice and due process. Mr. Latofsky has just stated that Mr. Bouchard received actual notice of the judgment in 2008 when they domesticated it and not before then. He then states that the 6 years they waited to domesticate it does not relate to the issue in this case.
Counsel, I don't know if that's a fair reading of what Mr. Latofsky said. It struck me that he said that assuming that he didn't receive notice until that time.
Okay. Well, there's no evidence that he had received notice before 2008. So then if you look at then there would have been no way for him to file a timely appeal or a timely Rule 59 motion.
With the exception of the court's letter. And I understand Mr. Bouchard says, I didn't get that letter. But nonetheless, that letter was sent to the address that Mr. Bouchard provided.
The letter does not advise him of the default judgment.
No, I understand that.
Okay. I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Court thanks both counsel for their arguments, and this case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.